Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. We've got a gigantic show for you. In just a little bit, we're going to launch into an analysis of some of the highlights of last night's CNN town hall with Senator Elizabeth Warren. Very exciting stuff. Some great quotes from her that I want to break down here. It's not all great news, but it was generally a good performance. And so we want to spotlight a little bit of that. Later on in the show, Fox News is pissing you off, and it seems to be by design. We're going to show you how that manifests in online sharing of content. Also, some Trump supporters finding out that, in fact, they're not opposed to dictatorship so long as he is at the top of the heap. Later on, we're going to close out the show if we have time by delving into a section of the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual for Psychiatric Conditions. There's a section that might maybe apply to a politician that you might recognize, and so that's going to be a little bit of fun. We're going to learn something, we're going to study, it's going to be a great, nerdy, dorky time. We also have two great guests who are going to be joining us. So Anita Malik is going to be joining us in just a little bit to talk about how her husband's health struggles in terms of the cost of medical care have led her to do a lot of advocacy work for reform in that area. Some of the numbers you're going to see that are just amazing. And then later on, Donna Norton of Moms Rising is going to join us to talk about some of the progress in getting big banks to stop funding Donald Trump's family separation policy. There's pretty good news in that area that we're going to be breaking down in just a little bit. But first, the primary. Senator Elizabeth Warren had her town hall with CNN last night, and it was pretty good. Pretty good, actually. There were a few answers of hers that I was not a big fan of. I think many people were sort of appalled at her ever-changing position on Medicare for All, where she seems, there's like a flu going through the Democratic primary candidates right now, where more and more just drifting away from a Medicare for All, which means Medicare for All position, and into, well, there's a lot of different roads to that village, and, you know, we're going to take one of them, but we have to be willing to consider many different options. And I don't think that's what people are really looking for. It's a bad move for her, but that's what she's deciding to do. But anyway, a lot of what she said was great. And in it, she was asked about white nationalism and white supremacy. And she was very specific about what sorts of changes she would like to see for the U.S. government's addressing of that issue.
We've got to recognize the threat posed by white nationalism. White supremacists pose a threat to the United States like any other terrorist group, like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, and leadership starts at the top. And that means you've got to call it out. Yeah. No sitting by. And then when you call it out, as president of the United States, you got to use the tools available to you. And that means get the Justice Department, when they break the law, to go after them with full prosecution. That's what I can do.
Okay, so you have to call it out and you have to actually do something about it. So look, she didn't talk a lot about Donald Trump during the course of this town hall, but it's very clear what she was getting at in that response. And it's certainly timely considering the massacre in New Zealand. So after that set of shootings in two mosques by a self-described white supremacist, a reporter asked Donald Trump if he saw white nationalism as a rising threat around the world. And look, this is an opportunity for the president to respond to an ever-increasing number of shootings, terror attacks, and foiled terror plots by people who identify as white nationalists and white supremacists. And so he took that opportunity and said, I don't really. I think it's a small group of people that have very, very serious problems, before saying he did not, at that time, know much about the details of the New Zealand attack, but that it was, quote, certainly a terrible thing. Oh, good. Well, if you kill nearly 50 people and shoot a bunch more, that's certainly bad. That's certainly bad. And those questions came long after the actual shooting. It was the next day. He had been briefed on all of it. So to say that he doesn't know the details is either just an insult, I don't care enough to find out, or he wants to pretend that he doesn't know so that he has plausible deniability and doesn't have to talk about the fact that the shooter actually praised Donald Trump as a symbol of renewed white identity. So in either case, it's horrible and the exact opposite of what Elizabeth Warren is calling for there. Now, we know what he's trying to do by not actually speaking seriously about who was targeted, who did the targeting. We've been talking about on the show ever since. Other politicians are also putting pressure on Donald Trump, with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeting, white supremacists committed the largest number of extremist killings in 2017, also 2018, by the way. What the president is saying here, quote, if you engage in violent acts of white supremacy, I will look the other way. Understand that this is deliberate. This is why we can't afford to sit on the sidelines. And she's 100% right. He is looking the other way, but he's not just looking the other way. He is diverting the actual resources needed to accomplish the second point that Elizabeth Warren was calling for there, actual action. As we've been talking about for something like 2 years now, Donald Trump took money and manpower from the FBI and other organizations that would be able to look into stop these terror plots when white nationalists, white supremacists, right-wing terrorists are trying to do things like this. He took that money away. He shut down those offices. So he looked the other way, and while he was looking that way, he allowed the actual people who might be able to stop some of this violence from operating. And so is it any wonder, is it any surprise at all, that in a poll that I just saw yesterday, just 19% of Americans say they believe that President Donald Trump personally opposes white nationalism? That, I would say, is too high. I imagine that a significant chunk of those 19% are his most devoted base, who want to say, oh, he takes every threat seriously. Even though that base doesn't take this seriously. I saw a stat. This is a mind-blowing fact of the day. People who voted for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election were 13 times as likely as Donald Trump voters to say that white nationalism and white supremacy are serious issues. And about two-thirds of Trump supporters say that white nationalism is either not a problem at all or it's a minor problem at worst. And so they are taking their cues from the top. This is the president saying this isn't an issue, you shouldn't worry about it, even though they're killing people around the country. And his supporters are largely saying, yeah, I think it's, meh, it's a couple people, maybe they have some problems, we shouldn't really do anything about it. But Elizabeth Warren makes clear that, of course, we should, and it requires political leadership to get that process started. Elizabeth Warren was also asked at last night's CNN town hall about voting rights, the ability of people to actually make their will heard during elections. And she addressed that, but she also went a little bit further.
I believe we need a constitutional amendment that protects the right to vote for every American citizen and to make sure that vote gets counted. We need to put some federal muscle behind that. And we need to repeal every one of the voter suppression laws that is out there right now. And I'll tell you one more. We need to make sure that every vote counts. We can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College.
I want to.
I think everybody ought to have to come and ask for your vote. What do you think? Yeah,
well, it seems that what they think is that they like that idea. I mean, that was one of the biggest rounds of applause that I saw at that town hall and at most of the town halls that I've seen in this cycle so far. People really like that idea. And I understand, I just want to get out in front of it. Some people are going to knee-jerk say, you Dems are just saying you want to get rid of the Electoral College because you just lost the election. It's opportunism. That's all it is. You're just mad because you lost, and you can't talk about this sort of thing near an election. That's what we're always told. It's like gun violence after a massacre. You're supposed to have some sort of buffer where presumably people would move on. So here's the thing. She's talking about it more than 2 years after the last presidential election, almost 2 years until the next presidential election. Almost to the week, this is about as far as you can possibly be from a presidential election. So I guess by the law of you can't talk about it after the presidential election, she is free to talk about it now. And so she's talking about it, and people are very receptive to that idea. And I want to talk about honest versus dishonest arguments against this proposal, the idea that we should get rid of the Electoral College and move to an actual popular vote that matters. Now, there are some people. I come from political science academia. I know that there are serious academics who are worried about ripple effects that might come if you were to get rid of the Electoral College. I don't necessarily agree with them, but I believe that they're being earnest when they say that this requires a lot of thought and analysis to make sure that we create what we want to create in destroying the Electoral College and not simply create new problems where they didn't exist before. But there are far, far, far more people across this country, including in political media and in elected politicians, that are not going to argue against this in that sort of earnest, concerned for the future sort of way. They're going to say, man, it looks like Democrats have been sort of screwed over by the Electoral College a couple of times in the past few elections. I think that they just want to win. And honestly, I don't want them to win, so I'm going to oppose any reforms. Now, that might be more honest than they're willing to be. They often won't be that specific on what their goals are. They will identify that the Democrats want to win more, but they won't say that they like the fact that this system tends to swing in the way that benefits conservative Republican candidates. But it is fundamentally dishonest all the same, even if they won't be honest enough about their actual reason for wanting to do this. And look, you can go back. How far, in the last 3 decades, how many Republicans have actually won the popular vote? I mean, look, George W. Bush did it in his reelection bid. That's true. But you have to go back decades to find that. And so at a certain point, the concerns for what might happen if we get rid of the Electoral College, the idea that, well, that's going to change how the politicians do their traveling and their spending of money, which is the whole point after all. But they say that that's a serious concern. That's a big problem. But look at the issue that we have right now. We, like, in the most populous areas of the country, you will be completely ignored. Maybe in a primary, a politician will visit your city. Maybe they'll come to raise money, but not really care about your vote. But other than that, they go to just a couple of areas. And look, those areas are important. And the people who live in them are as important as any other Americans. As important as the same number of other Americans, I would say. And there are a lot more Americans in other parts of the country that deserve some respect from the candidates as well, some interest from the candidates as well. Now look, she's talking there about getting rid of the Electoral College. She also, I want to give her credit for speaking with passion and authenticity on the issues of voting rights, voting access, voter suppression, and those topics as well. Elizabeth Warren has, I think, fairly well-deserved reputation for speaking academically. Like I guess I probably did when I used to teach classes. Not as an activist, not as, it's not Barack Obama, you know, like firing up a crowd. But there, she did kind of speak that way. And that says to me that this is an issue that she takes seriously, and it's an issue that deserves to be taken seriously. I think that while we're going to have a number of different litmus tests during this primary process, this needs to be one. Making sure that everyone that wants to vote can vote, that everyone who in the past hasn't wanted to vote has a reason to vote, and that their vote actually counts for something. I think that making democracy one of the biggest issues in this next presidential election is not just a good thing for the Democrats, but necessary to make sure that we actually have a democracy in practice and not just, you know, written down somewhere in our Constitution. With that, I want to turn to one more thing came up during the Elizabeth Warren town hall that I found to be amazing, and it was where she was asked about faith in politics and what her faith means to her in politics, and here is what she said.
What it is for me is the importance of the lessons we learn when we remember our values, when we remember our faith. The story for me is Matthew 26. And I'm sure some of you, a lot of you, know this story. You know, this is the one where the shepherd is dividing the world into the sheep and the goats. And as we all know, sheep are going to heaven, goats, nah, they're not. And the sheep ask him, why us? Why us, Lord? Why did you pick us? We look like those guys. And the shepherd, the Lord, answers back by saying, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me water. I was in prison and you visited me, naked and you clothed me. Inasmuch as ye hath done it unto one of these, the least of thy brethren, ye hath done it unto me. And what I hear in that is two things that guide me every day. The first is there is God, there is value in every single human being. Every single human being. And the second is that we are called to action. That passage is not about you had a good thought and held on to it. You sat back and were just a part of that, you know, thought about good things. It does not say you just didn't hurt anybody and that's good enough. No, it says you saw something wrong. You saw somebody who was thirsty. You saw somebody who was in prison. You saw their face. You saw somebody who was hungry, and it moved you to act. I believe we are called on to act.
Damn, look, again, not everything that she said during this town hall did I agree with, but that was powerful stuff. And I say that as I'm as about as secular as you can get in the U.S. Not only do I not vote based on any sort of religious values, since I don't hold them, I'm naturally, historically, pretty suspicious of candidates who talk a lot about religion. And she's not the only one at a town hall that brought up her religious faith. But even as secular as I am, what she just described there, that was powerful. Like, when I first heard that, I teared up a little bit, because you can hear in her voice that this is not the sort of religious pandering that we hear all too often, including from Donald Trump, who might be more secular than me, but certainly pretends he talks up a big game about his evangelical credentials or the fact that he's a Christian in any event. But there, I mean, you can see why she has done what she's done through the course of her life, both before and after politics. She is driven by what I would say is the most sincere sort of form of what Christianity is supposed to represent in American politics. And you can see how it drives not just her political values, but the particular policies that she supports. And I think a lot of people can get behind that. Again, I think that Elizabeth Warren, in terms of her campaigning, in terms of her speeches, she has a little bit of trouble connecting with people. But in this town hall, there were multiple times where I think she broke through that. And I think that what we just saw might have been the strongest example of that yet, where she was speaking in a way that connected immediately with the crowd about, you know, I would say an area of politics and life that might not be super important to me, but to many people is. And I think that if she can maintain that sort of passion, that sort of authenticity, and express her values in a non-academic way, in a way that really connects to people, she is going to do better in this primary than I perhaps thought that she would before this town hall. Anyway, we're going to have more to say about Elizabeth Warren in the near future. We do have to take a break. When we come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Look, generally, when we talk about the healthcare crisis in America, when we talk about medical debt, we talk about it with gigantic statistics. It's divorced from the realities of individual people's life. And I do that too, honestly. I like stats, but it affects individual people in a very real way. And so I want to switch gears and I want to focus on how the current system we have can do a lot of damage to individual families. And helping to do that, I want to invite back to the show mother and tech executive Anita Malik. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, John.
It's great to have you here. So I read your recent write-up about the experience that your family went through where there was a great sickness and even greater medical bills, including a gigantic one. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, for sure. So yeah, my husband got sick toward the end of our campaign, actually in the general in the 2018 election here in Arizona. And it was an unknown out of nowhere, and that's kind of the key to the story, unexpected. Completely healthy individual, a very rare occurrence of this to actually happen. And what we dealt with is, you know, we had great insurance, actually on COBRA since I decided to run for office. And we went and switched over to the ACA the beginning of October. So he was in this situation from September to November in the hospital. And what we've dealt with is, although we paid high premiums, you know, spent a lot of money on premiums last year, have high deductibles, we still had about $30,000, $31,000 of bills coming in over the last few months. And then for the last few days of November, we got our insurance claim denied and received a bill for $142,000 for about 10 days of hospital care. So for me, this has become, like you said at the beginning of the segment, a personal issue and an issue that needs to be discussed, I believe, with the stories of people and individual families so we really can put a face to what is happening in our country.
So I want to talk about what you just went through and make sure that people understand what's going on. You had insurance.
Yes.
Like, you had it. But yes, because of what I would classify as a weird technicality, it didn't mm-hmm. matter in this particular case. So why is it that for that gigantic single bill, right, your insurance didn't cover a greater portion of it?
So we switched. That was the time that we went from our COBRA coverage ending to the ACA. And in Arizona at the time when I applied for the ACA, which was a plan as a family to do, not knowing we would be dealing with a catastrophic illness, was one plan. There was one plan available. My husband was in the top brain surgery hospital here in Arizona that people actually fly into, and we weren't going to move him. So the argument and the issue with our system today is continuity of care, is people being able to opt out of different insurance programs. That's the bottom line issue of having private insurance be our solution to healthcare, is that we turn into this capitalistic system of you get what you pay for, right? And I wasn't going to move him, so I had to make a choice as a wife of, here's a gamble. I have no idea what this bill is going to look like, but it was life or death at that situation, so I wasn't going to move him.
Yeah, and people throw around the term life or death, but in this case, it very much was. And I imagine that while you chose one way, some people who are scared about their families being destroyed by medical debt might be willing to take more of a risk. And in those cases, I mean, we don't necessarily hear their stories, but people could either suffer far greater medical long-term effects or could lose their lives as a result of not being given a true choice. Again, you had health insurance, but mm-hmm. you were stuck with what you were given and ended up with, as you describe online, as an unthinkable choice.
Right, exactly. And, you know, you have health insurance, you're paying premiums, you're willing to meet that deductible, you know the cost going in, but yet you still, you know, what's been interesting to me as I've gone through this is finding the statistics of, we talk about, like you said, medical debt and people going bankrupt. But why they're going bankrupt often is because of a situation like mine where their claim is being denied. And, you know, people will, I think in crisis situations, in catastrophic car accidents, sudden illnesses, as we had, you don't even have time to make that financial choice. I don't think the system is even, you know, doctors, to their credit, medical professionals aren't stopping and saying, let's check your insurance when you're in this type of emergency, and they shouldn't. I mean, life is on the line. And so you also are met oftentimes with things that are out of network. Even though you're in an in-network facility, you've made the choice to go in an in-network facility, and we saw that happen with ambulance rides that he had to take back and forth. It happens often if the in-network anesthesiologist for an emergency surgery is not there. Maybe an out-of-network physician will come in and do the job. Again, you're not going to wait around to see if your insurance is going to cover that. I think the big issue is on the prevention and wellness side, where maybe somebody in a family is having chest pain or an unusual symptom that they're considering, should I go in for treatment? What's this going to cost me?
Yeah.
And a couple of days later, they might be in a catastrophic event of their own because they didn't go in to seek treatment because they were worried of the cost.
Yeah, which could result in a worsening condition that's going to be more expensive to treat when they finally do treat it, or it could result in them dying before ever getting treatment. So
exactly.
As we're having this conversation nationally, especially in the Democratic primary, about what should be done to reform the system, the response is always, well, how are you going to pay for it? You know, what's the cost? But as you are making clear in the experience of your family, there's a cost to the current system, a cost mm-hmm. in dollars, but also potentially in catastrophic results for your family. And so my last question, I'm just curious, what is the current status inside your family? How are you dealing with these problems?
You know, we're going through with the appeals process. We're with both the insurance and the hospital is providing us some opportunities for financial assistance. You know, this is kind of the traditional way that American families have to deal with this is you make payment arrangements, you look for applying for assistance, you go through the appeal, and we're going through the appeal of continuity of care in his case. And we don't know what the final number will be. We know we'll still have a large bill. We will, you know, pay it as we can and work with the system. But I will say that system in and of itself, that piece of it for a caregiver who I've been, you know, he's doing wonderful now, but you are suddenly dealt with a new stress. You're grateful for the life that was saved. You're grateful to the medical community, but now you have to figure this out. And I could be making money, or I can spend hours upon hours of time on the phone dealing with this situation. And frankly, I do that. I have to spend a couple hours, you know, every day, sometimes, you know, 10 a week, just to get this process going so that we're not, you know, completely straddled with this debt or in a situation where we're going to be forced to go bankrupt. But we are doing well. We're taking it one day at a time. That's all you can do.
And you've just identified another cost as well in terms of time and stress
for your family too. Mm-hmm.
We certainly hope that you're successful in your appeal process. You know, my heart goes out to you and your family. And I want to thank you, Anita, for joining us on the Dan Report today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I really want to just take a minute to encourage, when we put this story out, so many families have come out and shared their stories. And I think that's what's missing from the conversation. So I would encourage people to reach out. I'm looking for ways that we can put those stories together and really bring a face to the healthcare crisis. So thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, lots more news to get to. So pretty much every time I consume Fox News content, I end up getting pissed off. But it turns out that I'm not the only one. I'm not necessarily getting pissed off for the same reason the majority of them are. And third, Fox News doesn't mind at all. It's actually part of a strategy, and that was made clear in a recent NewsWhip study that looked at how content gets disseminated online. Who is getting the most shares? Who's getting the most reach with their content? And what sort of reactions is it actually inspiring? Like, I like to imagine that if people are sharing our videos, it's because they're learning something about the world. It's stimulating either curiosity or empathy, something like that. There aren't necessarily emojis for those things that you can respond with, but I like to imagine that that's what's happening. But Fox News and other right-wing media outlets are not generating that sort of reaction. So let's take a look at who is getting the most engagement on Facebook. And I understand that if you look at this graph, you're not going to be able to read all that. But understand that at the top, Fox News actually gets the most engagement. NBC, BBC, Daily Mail, that's horrifying. CNN, you're seeing some sort of just mainstream, New York Times, Huffington Post. But there are things like Fox News, like Breitbart, like Lad Bible, that's great, who are not like normal mainstream media outlets. But Fox News is the king right now. And what sort of engagement are they actually getting? Well, let's bring up this next one. You're going to see ranking those publishers by how many angry responses they get. And you can see that Fox News is far and away the lead. Over every other media outlet, people are responding with anger. Now, you might see that and think, well, John, you're posting an angry face. No, first of all, I don't follow Fox News because I have a little bit more respect for my mental health than that. But I don't think that that's actually what it is, because if you look at the other top contenders in that pages with the most angries, you see that, yes, look, Fox News was the highest on the other chart. You might say, well, they're going to get the most of all kinds of responses. But look at Breitbart in second. Breitbart was far down that list that we just looked at. Look at official Ben Shapiro in third. He wasn't even on that list. So despite the fact that Breitbart and Ben Shapiro aren't getting that much engagement compared to other pages, they are getting the most enraged engagement. And I ask you this, do they not know that? Do you think that it's some sort of accident that these right-wing media outlets are getting people pissed off? I don't think so at all. I think it is part of a strategy, a brand building thing where they know that their audience can rely on them to piss them off, not at random, not at everything, but in particular directions. And here's the thing. Some of you might be saying, well, I get pissed off at all sorts of content. Sometimes when I watch TDR or TYT, I get pissed off. And that's true. Sometimes I'll listen to a politician I support give a speech, and I end up with rage. But where is it being directed? Like, for instance, if I'm talking about people like losing the right to vote or the access to vote, you might be pissed off about that, but that is a productive anger. Bernie Sanders often causes people to feel sort of righteous indignation. But that is a productive thing designed at righting wrongs and protecting the rights and increasing the rights for different elements of American society. Is that what Fox News and Breitbart and Ben Shapiro are doing? Do you really think that? Or do you think that it's a little bit cheaper, a little bit shallower, a little bit more xenophobic and misogynistic and Islamophobic and homophobic? I have watched enough of their content to know what their strategy is, and it is identifying enemies. Individuals, whether it be, you know, Chuck and Nancy or AOC or, you know, Tom Steyer or other billionaire boogeymen, or entire groups, entire religions in some cases, the transgender community, get pissed off about them. And they are riding that to greater reach and engagement than any other outlets on Facebook right now through harnessing righteous anger on the part of generally older white conservatives. And if you think that that doesn't have negative ripple effects on American politics, you need to pay a little bit more attention to what they're doing over at Fox News and these other outlets. Let's talk about one of potentially the consequences of that. Look, Steve Bannon is apparently out with Donald Trump, but he's not out all over. He's actually out in Europe, actually, holding events. He's starting some sort of gladiator training school for right-wing white nationalists. And he's also holding events, getting people pissed off, but continuing to support Donald Trump. And on Showtime's The Circus, they had a little bit of a video from one of Steve Bannon's events. And look at what one of Trump's devoted followers ends up saying with the prompting and encouragement of both Steve Bannon and the audience.
He's supposedly representing us in Washington.
Seriously, if you want to take it back, it's citizen involvement. You can take the trash out.
Oh, Lord. Never in my life did I think I would like to see a dictator. But if there's going to be one, I want it to be Trump.
Okay, so it's easy to see that and just be angry at that woman. She is, after all, saying that she is okay with an American dictatorship as long as the politician that she worships is the dictator. But I want to give her a little bit of credit for being honest. Now, yes, she's being honest in a bubble. The right loves to pretend that it's only the left that has bubbles, but I imagine that a lot of people agree at these Steve Bannon events. But she's being honest there. Her attachment, her devotion to democracy is kind of thin. It's a little bit shallow. And if she feels like, oh, I'm mad at the other side, and maybe Donald Trump could seize power, and maybe he could hold on to power for the rest of his life, and then I would always have someone in the White House that I support, she's okay with that. And she is willing to jettison hundreds of years of American democracy so that Donald Trump, an invention of a pretty successful multi-decade-long branding campaign, as well as a lot of reality television, should be the unilateral source and holder of power in American government. And look, she's not the only one. A lot of Trump supporters believe that. A lot of Americans' attachment to democracy is waning in recent years. If you take a look at this poll, this is a recent one from, I think, last October, the percentage of the population that says that non-democracies can be preferable is in no age category negligible. Even 64-year-olds, those who've experienced the massive wars that we fought supposedly to protect American democracy, is at 11%. And if you look at 18 to 29-year-olds, it's one-third of the population says that in certain circumstances, maybe democracy isn't actually the best way to organize our government. And look, we don't have particular partisan breakdown for those, but I know enough about the authoritarian personality to say where the bulk of that lies. Many of those people probably at Steve Bannon events. And again, their attachment, their feeling that we need to maintain American democracy, that that is how we protect the rights of people and improve our society and make sure that people are not victimized either by out-of-control capitalism or an out-of-control government, it is paper thin at best. And if Donald Trump wants it, if he decides that if he loses this next election, he's not going to step down, you will find that many Americans are going to enthusiastically support him holding on to power by any means necessary. We'll be back after this. The Trump administration's family separation policy didn't come just from the minds of Stephen Miller and Donald Trump, and it required the participation of a number of other individuals and bodies, including obviously the Department of Homeland Security, people at the border, and also in many cases for funding from the big banks. And thankfully, at least one is now signing off from that. And joining us now to talk about that issue is Donna Norton, Executive VP of Moms Rising. Donna, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you on, especially to talk about this particular topic. So your group, Moms Rising, has been fighting Trump's family separation policies for some time in a number of different ways. Talk to us about the banks and the influence that they've had over this policy and the updates on that topic.
Well, private prisons are actually housing about 75% of the immigrants who are detained by ICE right now under the Trump administration. And the banks actually are lending money to the private prisons that enable them to really expand their ability to build new facilities, to detain more and more immigrants. And so the banks have been part of the problem with the ability of the Trump administration to just continuously expand and detain more and more people. And so we are part of the Families Belong Together Coalition, which started after the big uprising of people in the summer when we realized that the Trump administration was separating thousands of children from their parents at the border. And there's about 250 organizations in that coalition. And we, among other things, decided, okay, let's knock off the money behind this policy. And so let's strategically go after some of the major banks that are providing the funding that allows private prisons to expand.
So the most recent update is that JP Morgan and Chase is apparently not going to be participating in this anymore. From your point of view and from the point of view of your organization, how important was that particular bank's involvement in this system of financing private prisons?
Well, they have been very important. They, I believe last year, the private prisons borrowed $1.8 billion. JP Morgan Chase, I think, provided at least $200 million of that. But the really exciting thing is that that announcement over the past 2 weeks has triggered other banks to also say that they are exiting relationships with private prisons. So in the last 2 weeks, it started with JP Morgan Chase, but Wells Fargo Bank, which was the second target of the Families Belong Together Coalition Corporate Accountability Action, has also said that they're going to exit from private prisons, financing private prisons. And U.S. Bank has also said that they are vastly going to limit their lending to private prisons. So in the last 2 weeks, we've had a huge victory for the grassroots, a huge victory for people using their consumer voices to say, look, we don't want our money going into these policies.
And it's a that's obviously a great development on this issue. It's also a great development that people are starting to take more seriously what banks are doing with their money. And so congratulations on these recent successes. I'm curious, though, the coalition, where do you go from here? What other corporations are you going to be targeting? What's the next phase?
Well, there are three other banks that under a 2016 report were shown to be financing private prisons. And so we're reaching out to those banks next. Those include BNP Paribas, U.S. Bank, and SunTrust.
Okay.
And Bank of America. So those are next on the list. Yeah.
And it's entirely possible that many people viewing this might be participating financially with those banks. So just this is something that maybe they can think about. And I'm curious, too, you referenced the launch of the big organizing last year. The L.A. march around that issue was gigantic. Mm-hmm. From your point of view, how important was public pressure in increasing scrutiny on these banks?
Well, I think that was hugely important for just raising the specter that people really care about immigrants and the Trump administration immigration policies. And that really was a constraint on the Trump administration continuing on that scale to separate children and families. And I think it's also, I think, you know, the banks also realize how important this issue is to their consumers, especially in Black and Brown communities, but across the nation. And it's been, I think, a huge
just restraint on what's happening. And people need to continue to raise their voices. They need to continue to act with their consumer voices and with their voting voices. The fact that we even have hearings right now on family separation and on the banks has been because we have now the House that can hold those hearings. So both votes and consumer actions are incredibly important, and we are having a difference. I know a lot of people feel like cynical about their ability to change things, but we know when enough people take action together, when enough organizations join together, enough people take action, enough, you know, we had people all over the country go to their banks and deliver letters about their concerns about their banks' investments in private prisons, that we can make a difference. Our voices really are powerful.
And I think that is a great note to end on. So thank you again, Donna Norton, Executive VP of Moms Rising, both for joining us and also for the great successes your organization and the coalition has had in this area.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. We come back one more segment. We're going to have a little bit of fun to close out the show. We'll see you on the other side. Okay, I want to say right off the bat, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. Just bear that in mind. I was in a grad program for political psychology, so I guess it's all the same, really. But I want to play a little game with you. So I'm going to read some excerpts from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition. And I want you to see if any individuals in politics pop into your head as I'm reading these. This is just for fun. I like to read, and so some light reading, the DSM-5. So this is the Diagnostic Criteria for Narcissistic Personality Disorder. That's our theme for today. And the overall description of this is a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, need for admiration, and lack of empathy. But they go into specifics, obviously. They're smart people. Let's see. Here is how you diagnose. They need a certain number of these. The first is, has a grandiose sense of self-importance, e.g., exaggerates achievements and talents, expects to be recognized as superior without commensurate achievements. That's a fun one. You got anybody? Anybody pop? Well, we'll continue. Preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love. Yes, everything needs to be a bigger, more idealized version of itself. The water's the biggest it can ever be. The cake is the most beautiful it can ever be. Those are just random examples. Requires excessive admiration. So sort of derives its self-worth from constant reassurance from people, from other people. Has a sense of entitlement, i.e. unreasonable expectations of especially favorable treatment or automatic compliance with his or her expectations. So you will be given things regardless of how much you deserve them. They should be yours, damn it, and people can't stand in your way. Is interpersonally exploitative, takes advantage of others to achieve his or her ends. So sees other people not as individuals deserving of respect in their own right, but means to an end for your own goals. Let's see, lacks empathy, is unwilling to recognize or identify with the feelings and needs of others. Now that, I think, takes two interesting forms from my point of view. One is not caring about people that are both not unlike you, but also, for the most part, just are not you. But then also, when attempting to appear to have empathy, not being able to really do it in a convincing manner and saying weird general things that don't get across actual empathy for other people who might be suffering. Let's see, is often envious of others or believes that others are envious of him or her. So that can be like attacking people for their own achievements. Like, for instance, if you were a politician and you felt like John McCain was getting a lot of respect, you would attack them and bring them down because you are jealous of what they have been able to achieve. And then finally, this is just a fun overall one. This is the umbrella over the rest of it. Shows arrogant, haughty behaviors or attitudes. Have you thought of anyone? I think maybe you have. Anyway, look, I obviously can't diagnose anyone of any sort of mental conditions. I'm not qualified to do that with narcissistic personality disorder or literally anything else. But while you might not be a psychiatrist or a psychologist either, you're probably a reasonable person. You're probably a reasoning person who could take a look at this and say that it's pretty safe to say that this is true of quite a few politicians. But perhaps most true of the one that we have given the most power out of any human on the face of the earth, someone who has nothing inside of them, derives everything from other people, in a particularly cruel, selfish fashion, who doesn't care about who is affected by what they do or what they say, and cares only about their own goals, their own need to be grandiose, to be considered the best and most beautiful and all of that. It seems dangerous. Again, I'm not a psychiatrist. We've had psychiatrists on. We had Bandy Lee on to talk about this exact sort of thing. But it's something to bear in mind. As we continue to have conversations about the 25th Amendment and all of that, it's possible that there's something scientific underlying those concerns. Now, with that said, thank you, everybody, who's watching the show today. If you have not already rated the podcast on iTunes, please do that. It is so important. I would love to get to 1,200 ratings as soon as possible. Thank you again for watching. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.